the case of the black hole in the middle of a spherical shell, phony Earth, let's call it, because the real mass of that system is the black hole. And you draw those lines of gravitational force starting at the black hole and going outward, equal angles in all directions, if you know what I mean. Now, if something goes wrong so that your spherical shell doesn't stay equidistant around that black hole, if something disturbs it and it goes a little bit, if the spherical shell gets shifted off to one side, you now have a higher concentration of gravity lines from the black hole toward that nearest surface of the spherical shell, and you now have unstable equilibrium. If it gets a little bit off to one side, it'll accelerate in that direction further and further off to one side. Pretty soon the black hole touches your shell and starts eating it. That's what I believe would happen. Over to you, John. K2RIW.
Okay, now I understand. There has to have something has to happen to the shell, some deformation to cause that error. But normally, if the shell is perfect, it should stay perfectly centered. But I see exactly what you're saying.
A question for you guys: the core of the Earth is one big piece of metal. It's a chunk. Now, question is: if there is the closer to the center of the gravity, you have the little gravity forces. Why then we have a concentration of the heavy masses in the center of the forces? Because what it looks like is when you go too far from the Earth, we have very little gravity. Then we go closer to the Earth, we have a big gravity, but then we go very close to the middle, we have even less gravity, so the speed of the person should decrease. I mean, it's a kind of very, very difficult phenomena.
Yes, it does look like a paradox. Let me drop. Let me get a beep.
That's what I said. A center of the gravity must be significant. It has to be a force that is pulling everything to one point. If the center of gravity is zero force, then we don't have a center of the gravity at all.
Dick, it's an apparent center of gravity. Gravity is from the total mass. KC2QIQ.
Hey, fellas, we got to wait for a beep. I'm trying three times in a row now to finish John's original question. I'm going to keep going back to it. We're going to get a beep. Stand by. I lost my thought. Oh, yes, John. When I've got that spherical shell of an Earth around the black hole, and at first it looks like everything is balanced, and if you and I constructed that thing as a science fiction, and there was a science fiction like that, I know the author, you'd have to have an extremely good servo mechanism that senses the fact that the spherical shell has started to shift off to one side compared to the black hole, and you'd have to immediately start applying corrective forces, because if you didn't, because it is unstable equilibrium to start off with. It's like being in the middle of a saddle, if you know what I mean. You start going off to one side toward the stirrups, you're going to keep going off to that side. That's unstable equilibrium. So if that shell, if the outside universe applies any external force to that shell and starts shifting it with reference to the black hole, your servo mechanism better sense that and restore it immediately. Otherwise, you're in a runaway condition. And I'll explain the core of the Earth and that great big chunk of metal in a minute. But over to you first on that one, John. Go ahead. Wait for the beep.
No, I fully understand your description of why that would happen. I was just negating the fact that there would be a perturbance that would cause it to cause something. But I understand your explanation perfectly.
When it comes to a perturbation, there's always perturbation. Solar wind, coronal mass ejection, the moon, the planet, comets, whatever. There's always disturbing forces. So it's just a matter of time, because you've got unstable equilibrium, something is going to disturb it. Now, I'm still convinced that if we drilled a hole toward the center of the Earth, and I measured the amount of gravity you sense, As I go down that hole, the gravity will get less and less and less, and when I get to the exact center, gravity will be zero. That is Newton's paradox. That is what the two or three different puzzles in Epstein's book, Thinking Physics, is saying. There's an awful lot of people who reviewed that book over all of these years. It is most likely accurate. I can't believe that many people are wrong on so many analyses of that have been done. Now, your next explanation is, how the hell do we have a molten iron core in the Earth? And because iron and dirt have different densities, let me drop. During the days that the Earth was truly hot and molten in its early days of formation, iron has a hell of a lot more density than Earth mantle material and water and other things on the surface. Therefore, during the time the Earth is truly molten, the iron is going to sink to the center. It is the heaviest, it's the most dense material you've got.
Yeah, but what is really pulling that to the center if the gravity is the lowest?
Even though the gravity gets lower at the exact center, still, at any particular radius from that center, you have some finite amount of gravity. As long as you've got a finite amount of gravity, you will differentially float things of a different density. I can take the cork floating on a pail of water, and I can swing that pail around in a circle around me so that the whole darn tail is experiencing 2 G's of gravity. That cork will continue to float on top of that water. I can put a steel BB in that pail of water, which sinks to the bottom of the pail, and I spin the pail so that the 2 G's or 40 G's, and the BB will stay in the bottom of the water, and the cork will stay in the top. Buoyancy works at any particular local gravity. So no matter what radius you're talking about from the center of the Earth, there is some amount of gravity there. Once there is some amount of gravity, whatever materials are there are going to experience differential flotation depending on what their density. The more dense materials will move toward the center, the less dense materials will move toward the surface.
Why is that happening?
Why is that happening? What? You're telling me, why is there buoyancy? Should I explain that?
Well, what I'm saying is, there is a certain paradox that you're too far from the Earth, you have a very little gravity. You get closer, you're being pulled more and more and more. Then you could go closer to the center of it, and then your speed decreases. That's what you're saying. What is the magic center of the gravity?
First of all, you do or do not accept that gravity gets lower and lower as you go toward the center of the Earth. You agree with that? Because the majority of people on this net are saying yes. Are you saying no to that? First of all, step number one, does the gravity get smaller and smaller toward the center of the Earth? Does Wesley believe that, yes or no?
Well, Wesley is playing devil's advocate, because the only way that the knowledge will be increased is when you get into the controversy. If you don't get to it, it's a communist. Nobody learned nothing. And to Adrian.
Yeah, but nobody's being a communist here. In one respect, we have, let me pick a number, we have 20 people who believe one way.
Yes, I believe the same way, but the thing is that I have to oppose that because I'm giving you a certain example. You have particles at the center of the sphere. You spread them equally because it's a Big Bang theory. They get reflected from the surface of the sphere, come back to the center. What is the center? What do it represent? How it works? And to Asia.
I'm convinced that that model you just given is different than the explanation required for why the iron core of the center is located there.
If we have a Big Bang theory, by definition, we should have nothing in the center. Everything explodes equally. But we still have a center of the gravity. Why is it the center of the gravity is still the center of the gravity if there is no mass in it? Density?
You've made another assumption that the cosmologists will not agree with you on. This universe, we believe it came from a Big Bang, but every serious astronomer has said multiple times, there is no center. You think you're in the center because everything is moving away from you, from your point of view. If you and I were sitting on another star, 1 million light years away from here, and we're on a planet going around that particular star, we're in another solar system, 1 million light years away from here, and we study the universe, everything is spreading away from us. Again, we'll think we're in the center. Every astronomer says there is no center.
If there was a Big Bang, and there was a one particular point, then everything is moving by inertia. By inertia, the body put in motion, stay in motion. That is understandable. I agree with that. But then, the center is exactly the center.
That's Wesley's point of view, but the respected astronomers do not say that. They keep saying there is no center. It's a little bit like being on the surface. Let me drop. They often use the model that it's a little bit like being on the surface of a balloon that's being inflated. There's a whole lot of dots on the surface of this balloon. And maybe there's another balloon inside that's also being inflated with a bunch of dots. But all of those dots are moving away from every other dot as the balloon is being expanded. You locate yourself on any one of those dots, no matter which one you choose, all the other dots are moving away from you. You will think you're in the center. You're not.
WS2N.
Wait for the beep and go ahead, Paul.
Okay, I always like the analogy of the cake in the oven. It's got a bunch of raisins in it. And as the cake expands, all the raisins are separating from one another. You know, that gives you the density instead of just using the balloon on the outside. You know, that balloon's good, but I always like the cake analogy there. So, in other words, Dick, you're saying is that originally established vectors still exist, but there is no center.
The astronomers are saying they cannot locate a center.
They cannot locate the center, but the vectors were established at the Big Bang. The vectors could not change no matter what, because all the masses were spread equally. So there must be a center of the vector at least.
We talk about Big Bang, we talk about a single point of origin, and the smarter people, I think, are saying that is an overly simplistic model, that it implies that everything was in one point at one time. A lot of people have analyzed it that way, but not everyone agrees. Also, a number of significant astronomical articles, cosmological articles have been written saying that there probably are multiple Big Bangs. There's not just one.
Yeah, I agree with that. So now, they try to drop the theory of the Big Bang because the vectoral physics doesn't agree with that. Is that what you think?
You're jumping ahead quite a few steps. All they're saying is they cannot locate a center.
Okay, they cannot locate the center. I'm sorry. They cannot locate the center, but the vectoral center exists. Yes or no, do you believe that?
I don't believe that.
Okay, so how come the original theory of the one single place was changed to the theory of many places because the vector of physics was contradicting that? Is that correct?
I don't know if there's enough data to come to that conclusion yet.
Okay, so explain to me, if let's say there was a one single point from which that all of the masses spread equally, it could not spread unequally, it was one single place, and then the original vectors of forces were established. Why then we don't have a vectoral center?
I think there's somebody in the other repeater saying something. Who was that?
Yeah, it's Eddie M. at M182H. You know, the piece keeps dropping out earlier. You guys got to leave a little space. We're missing half the conversation.
That was M2ZM making a smart-out comment about leaving a space for the beep.
Yeah, these excited guys start talking on top of each other. Very hard to control this group. Let's get back to the main thing that's bothering you, and that is the iron center of the Earth. If you do believe, and you sort of said you do believe, that the gravity of the Earth gets lower and lower as you get to the center. However, with the gravity getting lower and lower at the center, you seem to be, as devil's advocate, saying that that wouldn't allow the iron, the heavy stuff, to be in the center. If the iron, the heavy stuff, is not going to be in the center, what would you put there on a molten Earth? Over to you, Wes. Wait for the beep.
It's a good question. And very well done. The center of the gravity is the zero gravity. Then there is a zero pull out. But I believe that any mass with the greater density will fall into the middle of the center of the gravity and stay there because they have no other way to go anywhere. So it would say that the density stands about the gravity.
KP2, QIQ.
Okay, Glenn recognized. So I'm going to repeat what I think you just said. Reluctantly, you're saying that the gravity of the center of the Earth does go to zero. And you're sort of accepting that iron seems to be the most dense material we know about. Therefore, the iron sinks to the center. Even though the gravity goes to zero, the iron is sinking to the center. You don't know of any other substance that should be there other than iron. Have I correctly summed what you're saying? Wait for the beep.
Yes, it is, because of the density. It looks like the density is responsible for the gravity, which is kind of another paradox. The first paradox is we're falling down from a very, very high, and then the gravity is very low, then it becomes stronger, then it's stronger, then it becomes lower. Now, what could else be than not the density?
Now, that's what I said half an hour ago, that the differential density determines who is up and who is down, even though you've got simultaneous differential gravity as a function of radius. So at each individual radius, if you've got some iron and some dirt, two objects of different density, at that particular radius, which has that particular amount of local gravity, the iron will sink, and the dirt, the lower density material, will rise at each individual place. You put that all together, and you end up with an iron center, assuming iron is the most dense stuff we know about. Glenn, wait for the beep. You got it.
Yeah, absolutely, Dick. And like we were saying before, is that the center is a point of equilibrium. So the heaviest items are going to be drawn by the gravitational forces towards the center because everything in nature wants to reach a point of equilibrium. In other words, that's where all of the lines of gravitational force are basically evened out. So if all the masses line up at equilibrium, then they don't want to move anymore. But of course, the heavier ones are going to try to make it to equilibrium. But the only thing in words that seems a little crazy to me, maybe you can straighten me out on this one, Dick, is that you were saying before that the gravitational force at the center is zero. I don't think that that's really true. I think what happens is that the lines of gravitational force are centered at the gravitational center. But even though the gravitational forces are at equilibrium, the weight may be zero, but I don't believe that the gravitational forces are zero. Let me pass that one back to you for a comment. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
You said the word weight, and I'm going to assume you really meant weight, and it didn't mean mass. Weight is the product of mass and gravity. The apparent weight goes to zero if the apparent gravity goes to zero. pay for the meat. You got it, Glenn.
Yes, exactly. In other words, the gravitational difference, in other words, the forces are there. In other words, that's the, like, the origin or the center of gravity. So in other words, all of the forces are basically at that point at equilibrium. So the differential gravitational force is zero, but the forces are still there, if you follow what I'm saying. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
You think the forces are still there. If the forces are still there, what instrumentation would you use to measure them?
Well, there again, we measure as we move away from the center, and then we can measure the lines of gravitational force from the center. So in other words, that's when we know where the center is, because that's the zero weight area. So in other words, that's where the origin is, or the center of gravity. So as we move away from there, we can draw all the lines of gravitational force from the gravitational center.
If I've got an ideal gravity measuring machine, and there is such a thing, as you probably know, the whole darn surface of the Earth has been measured quantitatively gravitationally. In other words, what is the local gravity magnitude at every place on Earth has been quantified. That was an experiment. It's more than an experiment. There's a whole lot of reasons why that was needed. All right, that's been done. You've got this ideal gravity sensing machine. And now you, by some magic, locate it in the exact center of this uniform Earth. And your local gravity sensing machine says zero. Is the force of gravity zero at that point? Over to you, Glenn. Wait for the beep.
I have a comment.
Yes, it is. Because the meter is going to be measuring differential force at that point. So because all of the forces at that point are in equilibrium, at that one point, yes, the measurement would be zero. But what I'm saying is that the lines of force are all meeting at that point. So to give you a equilibrium of zero. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Comment.
Hold on a minute, Grant West. You gave me a yes and a no. At that point, is the local gravity zero? Yes or no?
It's at equilibrium, so all the lines of force are basically between those two bodies, because they're in equilibrium, are at zero differential. Zero, yes.
Okay, wait for the beep. You got it, Wes.
Intuition. There are three methods of measuring the gravity. The falling body measurement. And this measurement is that the one drop an object and directly compute the acceleration the body undergoes by the carefully measuring the distance and the time of the body fall. The other one is pendulum measurement. And it is a gravitational acceleration that is estimated by measuring the period oscillation of the pendulum. And the third one is the mass on spring measurement. And that is simply by suspending a mass on spring and observing how much the spring deforms under the force of the gravity, and estimate of the gravitational acceleration that could be determined by this method.
Okay, I'm glad you gave us that. That's good information. So there are three respected techniques for measuring local gravity force constant. If I used all three of those methods, and I located the thing at the exact center of the Earth, would all three give me an answer of zero? I'm going to ask Wesley first, and then Glenn in that order. Wes, wait for the beep and give me an answer.
But they will not.
Which one will not measure zero?
The pendulum.
So the pendulum is going to continue to swing in the center of the Earth. Is that what you're saying?
Correct.
Is the pendulum only swinging by way of the weight being sensing a gravity field?
No, by inertia.
What is the restoring force?
There's no restoring force. When the pendulum is going left side, it is experiencing unevenness of the gravity field. It's interacting with the gravity line. When it goes to the right, it does the same. It will be pull by push.
Okay, by the same token, I could say the weight on the spring is going to move to a different position, which has a different gravity constant. You see, you're assuming now that the magnitude of motion of the pendulum is very large compared to the center of the Earth, so to speak.
Well, we didn't establish how long is the pendulum.
If you and I use a reasonable pendulum of 1 foot long, and I'm in the center of the Earth, am I really, with that pendulum, going to see a differential gravity? Wait for the beep.
So what is going to happen is that the pendulum is going to go around. You are the center, the point of the where the pendulum is hung is exactly the center of the Earth. But if one point in motion stays in motion, that's what you're going to have. You have given field of the gravity is going to go around. If you move the center of the hung up, then it's going to be what I said before, pull and push.
Disagree.
No, the center of the pendulum, in one example, the center of the pendulum, the bottom part, is going exactly through the center. And let's say the pendulum is 1 kilometer or 1 mile high, as long. Now, when it swings, it goes to the center of the gravity, and it's going to be crossing the lines of the gravity. It's going to be working by inertia, left and right, left and right. Now, when we move the center of where the pendulum is hanged to the center of the gravity, it's going to go around and to exert.
I think to a degree you're right, but we've now got to look at the real degrees of the real world.
Glenn disagrees, so I wonder what he's going to say.
If the real world has a radius of 4,000 miles, which is probably around 6,000 kilometers, and if my pendulum is 1 foot long, the ratio of 1 foot to 6,000 meters, 6,000 kilometers, 6 million meters, if I'm comparing 1 foot to 6 million meters, am I really going to see any significant amount of restoring force, Glenn? I mean, West?
No matter how short is the arm of the pendulum, the effect should be the same, but the masses should be smaller, because then we're talking about we're talking about the mass that at the point exactly of the zero gravity is zero, and we're crossing it when the center of the pendulum is exactly crossing the center of the gravity on, let's say, 1 mile long string, whatever it is. Now, when we put that hanging point exactly at the center, then the pendulum could go around, because the force is equal.
Can I have a chance on this one?
I'm going to say, Wesley, that if I have a 1 foot long pendulum and I try to locate it at the center of the Earth, and yes, any deflection of that pendulum takes me a little bit away from the center, and now there's going to be a slight restoring force. However, the period of that pendulum is going to be 1 million years. You and I are not going to see it. Glenn, go ahead, Glenn. Wait for the beep.
Okay, Wesley, the reason I disagree is because, let's just talk about how a pendulum works. A pendulum is suspended from a point. It has its mass towards the bottom someplace, a heavy mass. You lift it from the center, and you let it swing back and forth, and gravity keeps on pulling it down, and the energy just keeps on swinging it back and forth, back and forth. Okay, now let's move it to the center of the Earth, where the gravitational forces are at equilibrium. So right now you have zero weight on that pendulum while it's in the center of the Earth. You lift it up to one side, let it go. What happens? It stays there. It doesn't move. Lift it up to the other side, move it, let go. What happens? It doesn't move. There's no motion, no gravity, nothing to move it. K4AW, KC2QIQ.
Stand by a second. I'm going to argue with Wesley on this one slightly. Stand by. You've located the bob, the weight of the bottom of the pendulum at the exact center of the Earth. Your pivot point is away from the center, an extremely small amount, but it is away from the center. The ball is right at the center of the Earth. When you swing the pendulum to the left, the ball is now no longer at the center. The amount of force it experiences is extremely small, but it is in the direction of where you started before you swung it. The period is going to be a million years. You're probably not going to wait long enough to find it, and you'd have to have a perfect frictionless bearing on that pendulum in order to see it move. But when you move it at all, you are moving it away from the center of the Earth. But since the center of the Earth is 6,000 kilometers away from the surface, you know, the radius of the Earth is 6,000 kilometers, and you're moving it a foot, that ratio of moving it from the center is so small, the restoring force is so small, that I think the period is going to be a million years. You see what I'm going in this one, Glenn? Over to you.
Precisely, Dick. I mean, as I said, if you basically lift that pendulum up to any one position, so close to the equilibrium or the center of gravitational forces, it's not going to go anywhere. Even if it's a minor amount, like you're saying, it might take a million years to move to get closer to that gravitational center. I think overall that if you started that experiment and you went down there, the first most obvious thing is you'd lift the pendulum up and try and let go, and you wouldn't really see anything happen. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Let me challenge that.
Yeah, all three of the techniques, Wes, require deflection. The spring has to move, the pendulum has to move, the falling weight has to move. No matter where you start, no matter where you stop, you're always going to be going through points of extremely low gravity and points of essentially zero gravity. So if you take it to the 50th decimal point, the experiment is going to seem to be difficult. But in the real world, the amount of deflection of all three techniques is extremely small compared to the radius of the Earth. You're going to get an answer so close to zero that you can call it zero, and within the usual amount of error acceptability, you're going to be getting a quasi-accurate answer. Wait for the beep. You got it, Wes.
And to extreme. Okay. Physics is going to be exactly the same, whether it's going to be a million years or it's going to be 10 times a second. Well, at first, we didn't specify the amount of force, and we didn't specify the length of the string where the ball is hanging at. Now, the ball is going through the center of the gravity. Now, let's say we have a few miles, or 10 miles, 20 miles long. But we give a very small force, so the pendulum is going through the center, left and right. And of course, it's going to take a long time. But when you give the more of the force, the deflection from the vertical is going to be even stronger, even bigger. So I could say, when we swing to the left, the force, no matter how long is the string, will still pull it back to the middle. Now, question for you. Would we have the perpetual motion there? Because we're going through the center of the gravity. And to exit.
I think there's no perpetual motion. You added energy to the system when you pushed it away from center. The best you can do is get that same amount of energy back in that pendulum. You're not going to get more energy back than you put into it, is my belief. And there's another problem here. Because of the way you're describing the puzzle, the problem, where as you move the ball of the pendulum away from center, you get an increasing amount of restoring force. Because of a change in the gravity constant as you move away from the exact center. That's not the way a pendulum normally works. A real pendulum on the surface of the Earth senses the exact same amount of gravity to the nearest 30 decimal points, whether it's at the bottom of its swing or way off to the major deflection, it sees the exact same amount of gravity. In our particular model, at the center of the Earth that we're talking about, the magnitude of gravity changes. Therefore, the usual technique for calculating the period of the pendulum has a crazy kind of nonlinearity to it. But these are all minor details. These are the 30th decimal point. They're there, but I think we can ignore them and come up with an answer good enough for practical purposes. Very similar to, let me drop. There's a classic set of mathematics that was used 30 years ago, 40 years ago. That the exact mathematician says, if I keep halving the distance between me and Marilyn Monroe, because of the way exponential mathematics work, I keep halving the distance, I never get there. The engineer says, after a few iterations of halving the distance, I get close enough for all practical purposes. I can reach out and touch her. So we're talking about exact mathematics versus practical mathematics. John, I know earlier you said you've got a question.
Let me just one more question give to you. When you have a sphere that is empty inside, and the body, it's a big sphere like the Earth, and the body is falling to the center of the gravity, how it behaves, but it starts from the, from let's say, very high altitude, like the very rare atmosphere, or whatever the gravity is small. I'm trying to compare how is with the hollow body, how is with the Earth. Trying to find how that force would physically look like.
The way I was taught central force motion tells me if I've got uniform spheres, whether the here sphere is hollow or solid, if I've got a uniform sphere, and I got a pair of them, one is hollow and one is solid, but they both have the same total mass. Once I am outside of the surface of that sphere, I cannot tell the difference. In both cases, it's central force motion. I could make believe all of the mass is concentrated in one little dot at the center of the Earth, whether it be the hollow Earth or the uniform Earth. All the mass is concentrated at one dot at the center. I calculate my orbital motions from that point of view. That's why it's called central force motion. And I'll come up with the exact same answers.
But the speed.
Say again?
About the speed. You're falling from the space where the gravity is very small. Then you're going through the Earth to the center. Let's say then you slow down at the very very close to the closer you go to the center, you slow down. I mean, I'm trying to see how it looks like with the empty sphere and how it looks like with the solid body. I mean, it's not going to go through the solid body, but the speed should decrease, increase, and decrease in both of the cases, right or wrong.
When you do all of your testing on the outside of the sphere, there is absolutely no difference, assuming that both spheres, the hollow one and the solid one, have the exact same total mass. On the outside, no difference. On the inside, huge differences. You can't compare one versus the other. Huge differences on the inside. Once you cross the thickness of the shell of the hollow sphere, all gravity disappears. Once you cross the surface of the uniform sphere, gravity decreases as radius to the cube power. Huge differences. Over to you, Wes.
Yes, I agree with that statement. But still, honestly, I don't know by the vector of physics what is the center of the gravity, how the vectors are spread, what makes the center of the gravity being the center of the gravity. I can calculate it. I cannot catch it.
Yeah, there is a crazy paradox here. If I started with a falling object, and I start with the object 10 miles above the surface of the Earth, and we'll ignore atmospheric pressure here, atmospheric friction. I start with an object 10 miles above the Earth, and I allow it to fall, and I allow it to accelerate. In the case of the solid Earth, it's going to be falling down a hole toward the center. In the case of the spherical Earth, the shell of an Earth, it's going to go through a hole in the surface and then down toward the center. The acceleration from 10 miles up down to the surface in both cases is identical. The acceleration below the surface of the hollow sphere and below the surface of the solid sphere are very different. You're going to continuously accelerate in the solid sphere. You're no longer going to be accelerating in the hollow sphere. And that's an amazing difference. We got to think about that one. John, I know you had a question. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
And Dick, can I add a comment to that? KC2QIQ.
Yeah, go ahead, Glenn. Wait for the beep.
Yeah, I guess when I was talking before about gravity and, you know, zero gravity at the center, and you said it again, you said that there's no gravity in the center. I guess the point that I was making, I know maybe I'm just a stickler with the words, but the gravity really is still there. It's just in equilibrium. In other words, all the lines of forces are at zero, but zero is a real number, right? In other words, because you can have, once the object moves away from the exact center of gravity, then the forces differentially start increasing. And, you know, you can measure weight as you go away. But in the center, the gravity didn't really disappear. It's just at a value of zero or equilibrium. That's really what I was trying to say before. So it's not like the gravity has gone away. It's just that it's in equilibrium at the center. And I think that might be also what's confusing Wesley a bit, because he's like, what happened to the gravity? The gravity is still there. It's just that at the center, when you, those two masses overlap, that they share the same center of gravity, then there's no differential anymore, so the value is zero. But all those lines of force are still there. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
When we've used the word zero in gravity, it's too exact. We should call it microgravity. NASA, when you're in the space shuttle and you're floating from one room to the other, they call it a condition of microgravity. Yeah. If you were no longer in orbit at 17,500 miles an hour, but you're in the exact same location, you would sense tremendous amounts of gravity. But because you're in this arcing path of orbit at 17,500 miles an hour at the 200 nautical miles above the surface of the Earth, you sense no apparent gravity. They call it microgravity. Gravity is there, but you no longer sense it. However, when I'm in the center of this particular Earth, in the real geometric center, I can stop my motion and try to measure gravity, and I can't measure it. It's a lot closer to really zero there, Glenn. What do you think? Wait for the beep.
No, I'm completely agreeing with you about the real value zero. When two masses share the same center of gravity, the effective value is zero at that point. But what I'm saying is that the gravitational force holding them together, in other words, because what's making it zero is that everything is overlapped and they're at center. So, you know, the gravity is there. It's just that there's no differential at that point. So it's zero, but it's not that there's no gravity. It's zero gravity. It's hard for me to explain this one. In which, if I'm drawing all of the lines of gravitational force, I have the center coming away from there. Those force lines are still there. It's just that now the two bodies of mass are sharing the same center, is what I'm saying. So the gravity is still there. It's just that at zero, there's a zero measurement, which is accurate at zero, but it doesn't mean the gravity is gone. It's still there. If any other mass comes, a third mass were to come around, those other two masses sharing their center, now you could draw those lines of forces between those two sharing the same common zero center out to the mass to the other side, and then you'd see the lines again, if you follow what I'm saying. They're always there. It's just that they're in equilibrium at zero. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
We compare this to the nodes and antinodes of the standing wave.
That's a new problem. John, KC2WGB, go right ahead with your question.
Okay, Dick. It's amazing. In the experiments with the wind punch machine, it brings me back to the hundreds of hours I spent working on switchgear, high voltage switchgear, and the problems of tracking. And now I'm wondering, after you talked about lightning and cosmic rays, the problem we had tracking on micartas and Pringle switches and glass panel insulators and polyglass insulators, I'm wondering if the same thing is not happening with the cosmic rays when we get the tracking on the insulators. I'm sure you're aware of that problem, so I was just wondering your thoughts on that.
Give me a few words on tracking of insulators. You've got some insulating materials, which I presume are porcelain-like things, these pie plate-like things. And you've had some failures of those, is what I think you're saying. And when you look at the failed units, you see tracks that were traced where you can tell where the arcing was taking place. In some cases, I'm going to guess that if you're near a seaside and you get salt spray on the insulators, and the salt is sufficiently thick, and it becomes damp, and it becomes a conductor. Your beautiful porcelain insulator has now got a conducting surface that can initiate an arc. And the nasty thing about an arc is that once you initiate it, stopping it can be very, very difficult. So is it those pie-shaped porcelain insulators that were suspending your extremely high voltage cables that you're talking about, and somebody was tracing a path across those of where the arcing was taking place? Over to you, John.
Yes, in the high voltage switches, they make compartments inside the metal chassis of these huge switches. They're walk-in switches. And on the walls and the ceiling, there's this, it's almost like a fiberglass. It's called micarta. I believe it was invented by Westinghouse. It replaced glass insulators and stuff like that. These are sheets. Some of them are 4x6 feet. And what would happen, you would have your tines and the staves would come through the back of these panels. There would be holes cut in the panels. And it didn't have to be near salt air, but it happens more frequently near the ocean. But it also happens in dry areas. Dust that collects on it, which seems to collect evenly on the panel, does not track in a straight line. It always looks like your tree branch description and a spider web. And it starts from the protrusion of the tine or the little contact fork. Now, the micarta has maybe a 4-inch hole in it, and there's a 3-inch insulator coming through it. It'll arc from that insulator to the micarta, and it will start. Maybe it'll only be an inch long. But it never travels in a straight line, and it usually works its way along the micarta until it gets to a bolt. Most of the bolts are nylon bolts, except the ones that mount the insulators to the metal frame of the chassis. Those are usually like 3/8 bolts or something like that, metal bolts. The same thing happens on standoff insulators. The tracking, it's amazing how it does it, and it looks like, if you look at the pattern, it looks just like a lightning strike. So I was wondering if the initiating of the arc is done by cosmic rays.
I see where you're going. Darn interesting question. In the case of the dust, which is a mildly conducting, corona-charging, corona-starting material, I know for a fact that if I've got dust on my Van de Graaff generator, on that great big metal ball on top of the Van de Graaff generator, if there's a whole lot of dust on it, the voltage that I can build up on it is tremendously smaller, and you'll hear a whole lot of sizzling sound, and you'll see the whole sphere glow in the dark. And each one of those little dust particles has a purple glow or a slight corona discharge around it. The only way you can stop the corona is to have a completely mirror-smooth metallic surface. Now, corona doesn't get a chance to get initiated. Everything is equipotential. So your dust is a randomized set of particles that initiate corona. The corona once it starts, is the corona consists of very significant concentrations of local ozone. Ozone is a very strong oxidizing agent. So in the vicinity of your micarta, that ozone is making chemical changes to the surface of the micarta. So I am guessing the randomized pattern, let me drop. I'm guessing the randomized pattern of the dust particles. Yeah, but the dust particles are randomized at a 128th of an inch intervals. And the tree branches you're talking about are probably, I'm going to make a guess, eighth of an inch, quarter of an inch long.
Oh, no, they could be a foot, foot and a half long.
Wow. Now it's more difficult to explain them. Could a cosmic ray do it? Absolutely. Cosmic rays go in every possible direction, and the number of them per second in any one cubic centimeter is a hell of a lot higher than you would ever believe. There's a huge number of them passing through your body right now in all possible directions. So do some of them run parallel to the surface of the micarta and pick up those particular dust particles, create an ionized path, and it takes, you know, in the case of a cloud chamber where you've got material that's right on the threshold of going between the gaseous state and the liquid state, so to speak, right at the threshold. And so your dust particles with the corona going through them, they're right at the threshold of initiating an arc. And along comes a cosmic ray and flips them over the edge. And is that cosmic ray sometimes a foot long? So with the straightness you're describing, and with the straightness we've seen in the arcs that we get in our machines, my best guess is cosmic rays. But I'm now a little bit troubled by the fact that when you and I see a real lightning bolt in nature, those particular straight paths are 120 feet long. Why such a big difference? There's a lot of things going on here. Over to you, John, K2LAW, wait for the beep.
Yeah, there's a lot of things going on, is correct. This also happens to porcelain insulators. Exact same thing, and actually they explode. Everything just explodes at those voltages. We have had, to show what you were saying before, we had a lightning strike on a piece of switchgear, which entered the switchgear and came out on one of the conductive tines, arced to the cabinet. Now, the lightning strike was only microseconds. Tremendous impulse. But being the voltage is so high, once that path was ironized, it went from the 100,000 volt time to the case by itself. It had a path, and it melted the case. And it did not blow any fuses because, obviously, the fuses were 400 volts, 400 ampere fuses. It was only drawing maybe 300 amps, but it cut that cabinet up like a welding machine. And you would be surprised, the polyglass insulators and the porcelain insulators, these are insulators that weigh about 50 pounds, they're about 8 inches in diameter, and they're maybe a foot and a half, 2 feet long. They just explode.
Well, once that arc got initiated, did it continue? And if so, what finally extinguished that arc, John?
We took out the Edison feeder.
Wait a minute. If you had a 400 ampere fuse, was the Edison feeder also good for 400 amperes? What took it out?
The anticipator saw the rise so quickly. Wasn't enough for the fuse to react, which is surprising, but the anticipator did shut it down. But it took about, I would say, 40 seconds.
Give me a few words. What is an Edison anticipator?
That's a device that's in like a circuit breaker or a disconnect that anticipates, it plots the current against time. And if it sees it rising, it can trip in microseconds. If it sees that angle approaching a nonsensical angle that can't be, it will drop the switch.
It's intended to drop the switch when a dead short occurs or when a lightning bolt occurs.
It will, on any type of pull, it will trip if it's in proper adjustment. It'll see that curve, that power curve, rising faster than it's adjusted for, because they know exactly when I close the switch, if I'm going to draw 350 amperes, all of those backup sensing devices are coordinated to protect false trips. And sometimes they don't work as fast as they would like them to work. But you can't believe what happens on that high voltage stuff there.
It does sound like you were working on something like a 100 kilovolt AC circuit, 60 cycle, or maybe 400 cycle. What is actually inside of an Edison anticipator? How does it detect that slope? What kind of hardware or electronics is there, John?
Well, the company, in fact, Glenn works for the company, ABB. They make anticipators, they make differential relays, all kinds of sensing relays that are just current sensing and time sensing, and you can program them. It's a little package that plugs right into the relay, and it's the same from, I would say, from a 200-amp switch to a 10,000-amp switch. They're just little modules that plug in, but they do a magnificent job, and they do save us a lot of money if they work right. So that's basically, it just anticipates the current rise time factor and takes out the system.
Kind of amazing that you used to work on a 100 kilovolt AC circuit that has the capability of supplying for some period of time close to 400 amperes, and now with your little Wimhurst machine, you turn the crank with your right hand, if you're right-handed, and you make 100 kilovolts of DC, but it only has a continuous current capability of something like 10 microamperes, and it's backed up with the capacitor of those Leyden jars. I think they're around 125 picofarads or something like that. So you get a nice spark because of the discharge of the capacitor. But the real current capability of that high voltage generator is, let me think now, 10 microamps versus 10 amps is a million to one. 100 amps is 10 million to one. 400 million to one. 400 million to one in current capability is what you're working on now on the smaller side, John. Over to you, K2RAW.
Yes, and when I look at those arcs on that Wimhurst machine, it reminds me of the coronal emissions we would get off of bolts that had a burr on it or a piece of large bus bar that wasn't either ball soldered or filed down and smooth. Would hear that corona hiss, and that's a scary sound because you get that hiss for a while and then you get an explosion. But you'd open the switch door cabinets, and at night you could open it up and you'd see everything blue. You'd see blue edges all over the edge of the arcs and stuff like that. And a lot of it had to have this heat shrink, very heavy heat shrink put on it, put in an oven and shrink it down to prevent the dirt from building up and trying to prevent it. But it seems that it just contaminates. No matter how well you seal the cabinet, it gets in there because they do have to be ventilated in a way, and the filters don't do a good enough job. So I have a lot of experience working with that stuff, and it's pretty dangerous. And when I work with the Wimhurst machine, I was looking at the arc and how it was tracking on different items that I would put there, different solutions on them, and things like that. And I saw that path, and it reminded me of the lightning that you were talking about, which tripped my mind thinking about this tracking problem we've always had in high voltage.
Yeah, your high voltage circuit is a strong attractor of electrostatic fields, very similar to what happens with the surface on the front end of a cathode ray tube television set. If you don't wash the dust off there every month, quite a bit of dust gathers there. Mother Nature senses that high voltage, and dust particles come along and say, gee, I'd like to be attracted to that, and zip, they get stuck over to it. So your circuit was gathering dust. The dust initiates corona. So even putting very smooth heat shrink tubing over your metallic objects, it slightly increases their radius. Maybe the dust is a little bit less attracted to the surface of the heat shrink tubing than it would be to the metal, but dust is going to pile up anyhow. Yeah, you got one more layer of insulation when you got the heat shrink tubing. Hopefully it was made out of something that was a little bit Teflon-like that has very high dielectric strength to it. Therefore, there's a little bit of a voltage drop between the metal through the heat shrink tubing over to the dust. Therefore, the dust doesn't see quite as high a voltage. What was the prime mover that was making your 100 kilovolts? Was it a step-down transformer from